In the Christian calendar, today is Palm Sunday, and it's the beginning of Passion Week, the week commemorating the drama of Jesus' last week of life. Most of you know the story. It begins with Jesus' triumphant arrival in Jerusalem, when he was greeted with palm branches and hosannas, and it culminates in the story of his appearances before some of his followers on Easter Sunday. Although this is the holiest week of the year for many Christians, many Unitarian Universalists today feel little sense of connection to this traditional Easter story. I can't resist telling you this joke. Some of you may have heard it. This joke, which illustrates our tenuous connection to the Christian passion story. It seems that a teacher from a Christian denomination came to teach at a Sunday school class in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. So she asks the children about various religious holidays, and she finds herself perplexed by their answers. She asks about Christmas, and a child pipes up and said, "Christmas is when a big bunny comes and hides colored eggs." She asks about Thanksgiving, and one kid says, "Oh, well, it's when we dress up in costumes and go door to door getting candy." Then she asks the children what they know about Jesus and the Easter story. One little boy pipes up, saying that it's about Jesus, who preaches to people and gets in trouble, and then gets killed and is buried in a cave. The teacher is now hopeful that at least this child knows something about a religious holiday. She urges the boy to continue, and he does. And then, he says, the stone gets rolled away from the cave where Jesus is buried. "Go on," says the teacher. "And then," says this little Unitarian Universalist child, "and then Jesus comes out of the cave, and if he sees his shadow, there'll be six more weeks of winter." I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Back to the religious story, the Passion story. A great deal happens during Passion Week. According to the New Testament, Jesus goes into the temple to drive out the money changers and the profiteers, angering the authorities. He teaches at the temple and at the various courts and in small communities all around each day during that week, making more enemies among temple authorities. Many of his most well-known sayings and parables occur during this fateful week. In the latter part of the week, he shares the Passover Seder, his Last Supper, with his disciples. The next day, he is arrested, tried, sentenced, and executed by the swift cruelty of Roman justice and the insistence of mobs of people who only a week before laid palm branches in his path. One of the Passion Week events that the Gospels recount is one that has always held a great deal of meaning for me. It held meaning for me as a young Catholic, and it still does, long after I gave up my childhood faith, long after I stopped believing in Jesus, literally as God. In fact, this part of the story has more meaning for me because to me, Jesus is fully human. After the Seder, as the story in Mark tells it, Jesus and his disciples go to the garden at Gethsemane to pray. A very depressed Jesus takes Peter, James, and John aside and confesses, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." He implores his three tired disciples to keep watch for him while he goes a stone's throw away to pray. But they keep dozing off, disappointing him with their fleshly weakness. While praying in the garden, Jesus experiences a moment of grave doubt about his mission and about his upcoming ordeal. He sweats with fear, understanding too well the danger he is facing. Knowing that he would be ultimately alone, that his loving disciples would get cold feet and betray, deny, and turn away from him. So he prays to his God, "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me." How fully human and how entirely understandable. As the Persian mystic Khalil Gibran said, "Jesus was a man and not a god, and therein lies our wonder and surprise." Jesus was afraid, just like any of us would be. He didn't want to face the challenge or bear the pain he knew was coming. We've all been there, though perhaps not under such extreme circumstances. Facing an ordeal, a challenge, a difficult path alone, wanting more than anything to turn and run from it. "Take this cup from me." Maybe we did run into some distraction, perhaps, alcohol, drugs, or some other comforting compulsion. Or maybe we fought with all our might to control the situation, to dissolve the pain by a sheer act of will, so we wouldn't have to deal with the challenge and the disruption to our lives. In his weak moment, Jesus prayed to be excused from the difficulty he believed it was his responsibility to face. But in the very next breath, he found his courage. And it was a particular form of courage, the courage of surrender. He surrendered his own will to what was for him something greater. And he said, "Yet not my will, but thine be done." Once, at a difficult time in my life, a counselor quoted those words to me. It was a time when I was fighting hard to make things happen in a relationship the way I wanted them to happen. The problem was, some of what was happening was out of my control. But there I was, flailing around, believing I could control the outcome. At one point, the counselor suggested that maybe I had done all that I could, and that the outcome was not entirely up to me. He suggested that perhaps I might now let go of the need to control, that it might be time to say to myself, "Not my will, but thine." That is, to let the process unfold as it was going to. That helped to wake me up. It brought me to the realization that I really could not control things, that all I had control over was how I reacted to some givens in the situation. I then began to realize that it was time to stop pushing the river and let it flow by itself. And since then, a few other times when I have found myself struggling too much to control a situation or worrying too much about a future that I couldn't control, I have used those words of Jesus as a meditation, those words so appropriately quoted to me by that counselor. "Not my will, but thine." And I have been able, with those words, to relax a bit and to let go. There is a prayer I'm sure most of you have heard. It's called the Serenity Prayer. And it has been attributed to a number of different people, Reinhold Niebuhr, St. Teresa of Avila, and others. It's a very simple prayer. "God, grant me the courage to change the things I can, the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, this prayer has become so popular that it's almost a cliche, yet it expresses a very wise and very difficult aspiration. There are certainly things that we can and believe we should change if we can find the courage. Getting out of an abusive relationship, making an important decision about our life's work, changing a self-destructive habit, taking a stand against social injustice. But there are also situations that no amount of action or willfulness on our parts will change, like making someone love you or stay in a relationship with you, or bringing a loved one back from the dead, or wishing away a terminal diagnosis, or forcing someone else to be responsible. What is especially hard and requires the wisdom of experience and sometimes that of a trusted guide is to know what really can be changed and what must finally be accepted. To know when to surrender action and will and let what is in progress just unfold. I've been known to be fond of quoting Star Trek from time to time. So this one is from the Voyager series. I love it in all its incarnations. So in this one Star Trek Voyager episode, this practice of surrender was very well illustrated. In that episode, the spaceship Voyager was experiencing strange distortions that were going on. Rooms on the spaceship were rearranging themselves. Systems were shutting down, and the frantic attempts at technological fixes by the crew members were not working to stop this from happening. The cries they had, that they had tried everything, didn't help them at all. The fixes, all the things they tried to do, nothing. The distortions kept on going. One character, Tuvok, the calm and cool Vulcan, says he has a suggestion. Well, the desperate crew is eager to hear it. So they stop what they're doing and listen. And Tuvok says, here's what we can do. We can do nothing. The other crew members exclaim, are you crazy? We can't just do nothing. They ignored his advice, and they futilely kept trying to manipulate things. But the wise Tuvok was able to surrender. He just stood calmly as the spatial distortions washed over the crew. The distortions, as it turned out, were caused by an innocuous force, just a curious but non-threatening alien life form, just exploring the ship and thereby causing things to ripple and rooms to shift and all of that. But there was no harm done, and the alien even left a gift in its wake, a kind of cultural exchange as new information was downloaded into the ship's computer. I thought that was a wonderful illustration of surrender. It is particularly hard for us in our Western culture to surrender our will. We're fond of doing and acting and controlling and making things happen. But letting things happen, letting go of the need to steer, surrendering our will, yielding, is a lot harder for most of us to do. The ancient sages of the East understood that yielding, giving up power, is sometimes paradoxically the most effective, courageous, and ultimately powerful way. The sage Lao Tzu, as recorded in the Tao Te Ching, says, as the soft yield of water cleaves obstinate stone, so to yield with life solves the unsolvable. Yield, and you need not break. Bent, you can straighten. Torn, you can mend. To try to control the outcome events, to believe that we always can be in control, can be an arrogant stance. In Lao Tzu's words, trying to control the future is like trying to take the master carpenter's place. When you handle the master carpenter's tools, chances are that you'll cut your hand. What is necessary for us to be able to yield, to surrender our will, is trust. Trust that the future can sometimes unfold just fine without our always meddling. In the many 12-step programs which people follow to help them deal with what feels like an out-of-control addiction, the very first step involves admitting to being powerless over the addiction. This step alone is a hard enough one to take, admitting that one's life is really out of control. But a later step, the third, is even more challenging for most people. It involves making a deliberate decision to turn one's will and very life over to a power greater than oneself. That power which is called God by most. Not my will, but thine, is the essence of that third step. The higher or broader or wider power one surrenders to and places trust in may be different things for different people. For Jesus, it was the one he addressed affectionately as Abba, his Father in heaven. For Lao Tzu, it was the Tao, the unnameable way, the cosmic process from which life emanates. For a given person on the 12-step path or on any spiritual path which involves the humble and courageous act of surrender, it may be God or God's amazing grace. It may be Allah or the goddess or the world soul or the unfolding process of the universe, the ever-renewing forces of nature, the power of love or loving community, or even the God within, that core of strength in the center of our being that we may not understand, but we know from experience can buoy us up through difficult times. Can we let go of our need to steer and direct and control our lives, at least at times, and especially when we can't control what happens? Can we let go enough to let a challenging situation unfold in its own way and in its own time? Can we ever stop pushing the river and let it flow? If we can, we may well find that we can float without sinking, although there is no guarantee. But we may discover in letting go that something supports us. Letting go of struggle, we may find that a new path opens up for us. Letting go of fear, we may be more open to love and closer to joy. I'd like to close with two personal examples of the practice of surrender. The first took place some 20 years ago. I went to Disneyland with my sister, my son, and my nephew. It was the first time I had been there since I had taken my cousin's daughter 20 years before that. It was a very rainy, non-holiday weekend in February. That was a good choice. There were practically no lines for the rides. My nephew was eager to go on the Space Mountain ride, which is a very fast roller coaster that takes off and soon tilts sideways. I sat in the car next to my 7-year-old nephew, and off we went. It had been a very long time since I had been on a fast ride, and I was terrified. My nephew yelled out, "Isn't this fun, Aunt Joy?" as we sped and we tilted sideways. And I said, yeah, Mark. But my knuckles were white as I held on for dear life. I got out at the end of the ride with very weak knees. But then I had a little talk with myself. I reminded myself that we were not likely to die on this ride, that it was actually pretty safe, and that in any case, gripping the rail tight and tensing up my whole body would not control what was happening. So I went back on the ride, determined to relax and enjoy it. When I let go of the fear and surrendered to the experience, I found that it really was loads of fun. Then I kept going back for more. And on this rainy day, I just couldn't get enough of those fast rides. The second personal experience was in a yoga class I took over 40 years ago when I was a student in seminary. I was fairly flexible then and could do most of the body twisting exercises and postures, but the headstand had me stumped. Try as I might, I couldn't do it. At one point, the instructor advised me to stop trying so hard and to just stay in the position prior to the headstand, the position of the child. It's a crouched position. She said, do that and just visualize yourself doing the headstand. So I did this. And some moments later, she came by, looked at me, and said, you're doing it, you know. I was actually in the headstand. To this day, I don't know how I got from the crouched position to the headstand, but I believe it had something to do with surrender, with giving up the struggle. I would like to end with a brief guided meditation that we began during our moment of prayer and meditation. I'd like to invite you to just take a moment to think about some situation in your life which is causing you or has caused you difficulty. And just hold those feelings for a moment in your mind. Ask yourself gently, is there something I can do to change the situation, to improve it? If you believe that your actions cannot change the situation, can you imagine yourself letting go, letting the process unfold as it will, letting go of the struggle to change it, letting go of the burden of trying to control, perhaps letting go of some of the worry, the fear, the concern? How might it feel to truly let go? As a reminder of the need to sometimes let go of struggle, I'm going to today give each of you one of these Chinese finger traps, as they're called. You may know how they work. You put your fingers in at each end, and the harder you pull, the tighter this thing gets around your fingers. In fact, in one Next Generation episode, to quote another Star Trek, the very intelligent robot Data gets his fingers stuck, and he can do anything. He can do math at wizard speeds, but he gets his fingers stuck, and he's showing the crew, and he can't get them out. No matter how hard he pulls, he can't get them out. Well, the more you struggle, the tighter the grip of this woven little finger trap is. But if you relax and stop pulling and stop struggling, your fingers come out easily. So, as we have our collection, you will give something for the benefit of this wonderful church, and you will get a Chinese finger trap. I like to keep mine on my desk at home to remind me that sometimes it's better to let go than to struggle.